Good morning and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Romain Guy from the Toolkit team.
How very proper. I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team. And today...
I'm Michael Wright from the Android Framework team.
Ooh, visit number two. Ooh.
Yeah, Chet and I are in London. We just went to DroidCon, and while we're visiting the office, we decided to have a chat with Michael again.
And GDG DevFest Reading.
And GDG DevFest.
Yes. So two conferences, one city. Amazing. Okay, two cities. So Michael was on the podcast several months ago talking mostly about displays and a little bit about input stuff. And let's flip that today and talk mostly about input stuff and also a little bit about displays.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, let's start with displays because
because it's more interesting than input.
Because it's first on the little note sheet that I had. So one of the new features in the Pixel phones that just came out, the Pixel 4s, is 90 hertz displays, which we've been thinking about for a while. So how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who was working on the graphics stack on Android that's been talking about 120 hertz on 90 hertz for about the 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's been a discussion topic since I joined. It's kind of been my pet project for the last few years. We've seen some of the more gaming-oriented phones ship with 120 hertz displays. Most of those are LCD displays. It's a lot easier to do on LCD for various reasons.
Wait, why?
Do you really want to get into the technical details?
I do, actually. Yeah, I want to understand
that's,
why.
That's interesting bits.
Yeah, so, I'm definitely not the expert in this area. It's mostly a hardware limitation. My understanding is that it's actually hard to get the brightness levels that you want out of a OLED panel at full refresh rates. So anything above 60, basically.
Does that mean like you can't get them to go off and on? Like they can't
yeah.
So, like, switch at that speed?
So the way that brightness works on most OLED panels is this thing called pulse width modulation. So basically you light up the pixels at their maximum brightness, but you only light them up for a period of time every frame. So you actually have like a thin band kind of scanning down the screen for every frame. And the wider that band is, the brighter your screen is, because the more photons you're emitting.
That reminds me of the old school technique used in old consoles for various video effects, where on every scan line, they would change like the scaling factor or the rotation factor. Here we're changing the brightness.
Yeah. I mean, not every phone does that. So there are some phones that do this thing called DC dimming, which is basically like changing the voltage or the current of the panel, and you just show a full frame every time, so you don't have that band scanned out. I mean, you do for pixels, but not for brightness.
And weren't there phones that were using RGBW displays, where the W is just a white light to increase the brightness?
I'm sure there are. I don't think we do that.
Okay. No, I remember them from a few years ago, and I don't think I've seen one lately, but yeah, I was wondering if that kind of stuff helps.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea.
Yeah, so 90 hertz. So we have 90 hertz in Pixel 4. I remember the reason why we were talking about 120 hertz a long time ago, before it was even remotely possible. 120 hertz is really interesting because it's a multiple of 60 hertz, which is what most phones use, but it's also a multiple of 24 hertz, which is what videos use. So it's interesting because on the 60 hertz display, when you play a 24 frames per second video, it doesn't match the frames exactly. So the video players have to, there's a technique called 3-2 pull down or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So why 90 hertz? Why not 120?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to that technology limitation. Getting panels that do 120 hertz on OLED is possible these days, but it has a lot of challenges behind it. So we opted for 90 instead, with the advantage of it's a bit more power efficient as well, while still giving you most of the benefit of a high refresh rate display. So for us, like, obviously we want it for video content. We'd love to have a 120 hertz panel. But 90 hertz kind of gives you the fluidity benefits. If you compare a 90 and a 120 hertz panel, which we did a lot of in the early days, it's kind of hard to tell the difference between them. You can see it, but it's not as stark as 60 to 90. 60 to 90, you definitely notice. So there's a lot of studies basically around what the just noticeable difference between refresh rates is. And as you go up, as it gets higher and higher, the gap between them gets wider and wider. And between 90 and 120, it's a little bit less clear that there is actually a perceivable advantage for most people.
Yeah, and I'm sure it depends on people, right? Like, some people can notice that more than others. Even 60, like, I know there are folks, when I show them 60 versus non-60, they can't really tell the difference.
They probably just blink too often.
That's definitely possible. Yeah, and I think the surprising thing as a user, I remember the first time I held a phone at 90 or 120 hertz. You know, honestly, I wasn't expecting it to be that drastic of a difference. I was expecting to have to look very closely to tell that it was running at a higher refresh rate, but it's very noticeable. And then actually it's even more noticeable when you go back to 60 hertz phone, like it feels very choppy. And once you're used to it, it's it kind of ruins it for you.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I originally sold the Pixel team, well, I don't want to say claim the whole credit for the idea, but the way that I got the Pixel team looking at it originally was we got one of those sharp 120 hertz panels, and I put one in front of them and like a Pixel phone in front of them and said, like, try both of these. And they tried the 120 hertz panel. I was like, holy crap, how do I get that? So we've looked at it a few times over the years. The original Pixel 3 wasn't actually the small one, wasn't actually going to have an OLED panel for various reasons. So I was like, well, if we don't have OLED, what do we do? And so one of the considerations was, well, maybe we do a 120 hertz LCD. So like, we've been looking at this for quite a while. We're really excited to get it into Pixel 4. I'm personally really excited to get it in.
Yeah. I'm very excited too. I've been waiting for this for years as well.
So this is specific to the Pixel 4, but was there something that you needed to do or the team needed to do to enable 90 hertz or faster processing in general, which makes it applicable to the overall ecosystem?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can kind of turn on 90 hertz on any panel today and it mostly works. Like, you know, you get smaller frame rendering budgets. But what we did for Q in particular was we have this dynamic refresh rate switching. So based on, you know, what content's coming in, whether there's a touch, so that's indication of more content coming, and a few other factors, we have actually dynamically switched between 60 and 90 for power savings. And we're pretty happy with where it is for the most part. There are some, you know, in the initial builds, there are some difficulties that I think have caught a lot of attention, but we're smoothing them out over time, and where we are at today is a much better place. And you get a quite a large power savings out of this.
And for developers, if we backtrack a little bit, so at 60 hertz, you have 16 milliseconds to render your frame, which yeah. You know, on Android means it's the drawing, but it's other things, right? It's running your animations, it may be doing some layout. At 90 hertz, now you have 11 milliseconds. So I guess it matters for apps to be optimized or at least well-written.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely matters. In our experience, apps are kind of bimodal. They tend to have really expensive frames, and those will be like 30 milliseconds. And then they'll have really cheap frames, and they'll be like 6 to 8 milliseconds. So most apps, if written well, are kind of fine in this new mode. That being said, the 16 milliseconds rule has been alive for several releases now.
Yes.
We haven't been too loud about saying this because we want people to target 16 milliseconds because obviously the smaller your frame budget, the better off you are. But that's not actually your limit. Your limit's closer to 20 milliseconds on those devices, and it's closer to about 15 on 90 hertz devices.
Yeah, and the reason is because we have the choreographer that sends the VSync signal to the system, but what we do is we fire it ahead of time, right?
Yeah, so we offset. So when you get a VSync signal these days, you're not actually getting your display's VSync signal. You're getting some offset from it. Because it turns out, like, what we used to do many releases ago was we'd fire it for your app, you would draw 16 milliseconds, and then we would fire it again, and Surface Flinger at that point would pick up the frame you just rendered, and it had 16 milliseconds to get it to the display. And then, you know, it'd fire again, and it would go to the display. So, like, end-to-end latency is long. And these days, we don't do that. We looked at it, and we said, well, Surface Flinger actually needs, like, 4 milliseconds to run, so why do we give it 16? That's ridiculous. We control this. So we shrunk that period, and we grew the app period by a little bit. So the apps have about 20 milliseconds between when we start them and when Surface Flinger picks it up. And then about 4 to 8 milliseconds, depending on the device and the build and things, for Surface Flinger to composite it all together and send it to the display. If you're following along, you might think, well, how can you give me 20 milliseconds when I have a 16 millisecond budget? And the short answer is pipelining, right? Like, so if you have the app run for 8 milliseconds, let's say, then we actually have all the drawing done in something called Render Thread. You're very familiar with this, I know. And then that gets another 14 milliseconds to run. But then the app can start doing whatever work it needs to. So the app is actually starting every 16 milliseconds, but it doesn't get picked up for 20 because you can pipeline the two of them together.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting thing because we could do like full pipelining, right? We could pipeline rendering while we're doing measure and layout, while we're doing something else. That would be amazing because, you know, you would have full 16 milliseconds for every stage of the pipeline. But then the latency would be crazy. So the trick here is to find the right balance between latency, giving the app more time.
Yeah, so one thing we did, this is back in, I think, around Pixel 1 launch time, whenever that was we traded off a little bit of latency to get some more consistency out of it. So what was happening before was you'd say, oh, no, if you hit everything exactly correctly, our pipeline is 50 milliseconds long. And then the second you fall out of that good path, the second you have one long frame, everything backed up and got slow, and you were at 66 milliseconds, and that's horrible. That just wasn't competitive anymore. So what we did was increase that a little bit so that when people, like, it was less likely you'd be likely to fall out of the good path. And when you did, we just backed up a little bit rather than the full 16 milliseconds.
And so for 90 hertz, I don't know if that's still true, but back when we did Project Butter, we introduced triple buffering. So the apps were in double buffered mode until they took too long, and then we would be triple buffered, so you gained a little bit of latency, but we would not drop a frame. At 90 hertz, are we still doing that, or are we always in double buffered, always triple buffered? Like, what do we do there?
No, the policy for that's exactly the same, because like I said, you kind of have this bimodal distribution of either you're doing really well and you're in double buffered, or you have one really long frame and you're in triple buffered, and you stay that way kind of until you stop producing frames. It's unfortunate. It's something we'd like to fix, but like figuring out how you get out of triple buffered mode once you've fallen into it is difficult.
Subtract a buffer. I'll just
thank you, Chet.
Yeah, we had considered that before. We'll give it a shot.
Michael will wait for your patch.
So speaking of Project Butter, actually, I wanted to talk about, we were going to talk about input and input latency. Yeah. And I thought maybe if we start with Project Butter, we can have a little bit of context for where it came from. To my memory, that was where we first started working at the low level on like latency issues and improving like input to display.
Yeah, I mean, Project Butter was the first time, to my understanding, I joined right at the tail end of Project Butter, so I'm definitely not the expert on this, but it's the first time we really started considering the full end-to-end stack of like input comes in to, you know, actually a seat on the display.
Yep.
As part of that, there's a bunch of things that went into that. Obviously, we had to drop input side latency down a lot. We did something called resampling. So when you get up to we did something called batching first. So basically, rather than sending every input event as a single event, we batch them all up and only send them when you're ready to draw a frame. So on every motion event other than downs and ups, you'll actually get like a bunch of touches batched together. And only the latest one is the one that you consider, because that's the one that's going to be seen by the user. If you want to do more processing than that, then you can look through the history and see all of them. They're there for you. But like 99.9% of the apps don't care.
I assume that a drawing app, like if you're drawing something with your finger, might want to look at all the motion events.
Yeah, exactly. So like there are definitely specialized apps. So we want to give that information, but not every app wants to look at it. So we kind of looked at it for the full stack for the first time. We paid attention to vSync. We weren't just continuously drawing for no reason. We batched up input events, so you weren't doing work that you didn't need to. If you render a frame, then you immediately throw that away and render another frame. That's kind of a waste, right? Like you don't need to do that kind of thing. So that's mostly Project Butter was figuring out like where are we doing unnecessary work, and where are we kicking off work that could be scheduled a little bit better.
Yeah, and I remember, didn't you do something, Chet, for animations where at the beginning of the frame we drain some of the events that might be in the queue before we run the animation code? I seem to recall there was something like that.
I don't remember draining. I remember everything started syncing to the choreographer.
Well, there was that, but I thought we were looking at motion events more often to give the application a chance to react, like basically to reduce latency during scrolls.
Yeah, I don't remember the specifics. Like, I do know that like the synchronization was the main aspect where, every frame we wake up and that is the time when the native input system has sent all the input events up there. So the first step in any frame is, okay, go check what the input is, process all the animations, and then take care of the, layout and draw. Right. Well, so everybody's doing everything synchronized as opposed to it was random before.
I would love to do for touch latency, it would be very difficult and we could only do it in very limited cases. But it's inspired by what VR does, where they call that late latching. Mm-hmm. So effectively in the rendering pipeline, they go resample the events like while rendering so that they can get like the absolute latest, because your rendering is going to take a certain number of milliseconds. So if you can refetch some of the events after that, you gain an extra like 4 milliseconds of latency. So when you move your head, it's really important because you can adjust the distortion. And we could imagine like in render thread, when we're processing our display list and we know, okay, those display lists are part of a list view, and we could look at the touch events again and say, oh, we've scrolled a little bit, not enough to show a new item. So the rendering pipeline could offset everything and just gain that bit of latency there.
I mean, so it's something we've talked a little bit about before, is this kind of late sampling. I'm actually not horribly convinced by it. Mostly because, like, the reason you could do this with VR and with headsets is you have these really high scan rate and sample rate inputs. Touch input comes in at 120 hertz, so you can only, if you're only doing it 4 milliseconds ahead, or even 8 milliseconds. I mean, 8 milliseconds, you have a bit more. You're probably going to get something new, but at 4 milliseconds, it's kind of iffy if you do.
Well, there's that. To me, I think the problem would be more that as you're scrolling through a list. So let's say that would work. We have the right sampling rate. We would be able to reduce latency. But as soon as a new item comes in, the rendering pipeline does not know what to display next, yeah. Right? So there we would stop having low latency. So I think the latency would keep going up and down.
Yeah.
And it might be noticeable.
It definitely is. I mean, so again, back to Project Butter, one of the things we did was this resampling. So basically, when you get a frame and you look at what your latest touch event is, it might not actually be a real touch event, because we pick a period of time in which we're pretty certain we know what's happening there. And that can either be because we have a touch event that's close to it. If we have a touch event a little bit after it, we'll actually interpolate between the last two. So we get the close to exact position of where you would be at that time frame. And if it's actually a little bit ahead, we'll do a bit of prediction and say, like, okay, if this continues in the same trajectory, where would the touch be at that point? And that's how we get consistency with timing and touch, which is one of the really important things that came out of Project Butter. If you remove this, you can see it. You know, humans are really good at noticing like small inconsistencies, and that's exactly what you'll see. But to go back to the point about late latching. If you schedule your input, right, this is the big thing that I've been pushing for the last few years. You need really tight hardware integration to do this. But if you schedule your input right, so you know the entire latency of your display pipeline and the input pipeline, and you send input such that it arrives just before the VSync signal, just before you draw, then unless you get super high sample rates, it doesn't matter. It doesn't help you to do late latching at all, right? We'd have to have significantly higher sample rates on input.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. And to your point, like what we were discussing earlier, if we're going to a 90 or 120 hertz displays, then we would need like touch sampling at twice that to start making sense for late latching.
Yeah, exactly. And that is actually something we're looking at. So one of my big issues with how we did in Pixel 4 was it's 120 hertz all the time. Switching between 120 and 180s was challenging and had a power cost. I suspect we'll change this in the future. If you do it at 120 hertz and you have a 90 hertz panel, obviously they skew against each other. It's not even a multiple of each other. So where you get the input comes in, where the input comes in changes every frame, basically. And that's not great for Butter.
Does the prediction help with that?
It does, which is part of the reason why I think we don't see it a lot on the panels. But it would be nice if we didn't need prediction, if we could actually just schedule things so they landed when you wanted them to. And obviously, if you think about it, if you can go to 180 all the time, it's a multiple of 90 and 60. So that's fine. It's just a question of getting power down and figuring out how we handle that much input.
So how much do these, you've mentioned this a couple of times for both input and display, how much does cranking up the frame rate affect power, right? So going from 60 to 90 for the display, or, you know, touch sampling at 120 hertz versus 180 or whatever.
I mean, it's pretty much linear, right? For the display pipeline, if you're showing, you know, twice as many frames, it's going to cost you twice as much power. There's very few components on there that are that don't scale with the amount of frames you're showing.
Well, there's that, but I assume since the screen is on, we also have to look at what is twice as much power for, you know, CPU, GPU versus other things that might be on anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, GPU power cost is quite high. CPU power cost is quite high. In terms of the system, the CPU and the display are basically the highest things that are running all the time.
Right. But so I've heard this before where, like, well, when you have the screen on, you're basically in, you know, highest power consumption mode. But does that mean that, like, displaying the buffers in that display actually take up, like, are you doubling the amount? I don't think so, right? It's just the display being on is taking the power, not how fast you or how often you sample that. Is that correct?
I mean, it's the work that you do to produce the buffers as well, though, is where a majority of the cost comes from, right? So if you're doing twice as much work, so you're going like 60 to 120, then you are going to have a significant hit on CPU cost there. It's not just like the display being on costs you something, but as you go look at all of our dark mode presentations, display on with, you know, a black screen is pretty much free. It's very cheap, at least. Like, you have to keep some things online just in case you produce a different frame, but it's very cheap.
Okay. Maybe we should just have black artifacts more often.
Yeah, if you want to talk to our design team, that would be great.
Okay. All right. I was thinking, like, you know, the sort of protect the identity of this person, just some of those black, just arbitrary black rectangles on the screen.
You never know what needs to be censored, so let's just throw them on there. Yeah, that's what we do.
In the, you know, in for the benefit of privacy, we have decided to display many black rectangles all the
time.
What if you
did, like,
face
detection?
By the way, your battery lasts longer.
Exactly. We just do it on, Facebook. Like, you don't need to know who this person is, but your battery life is really good.
Perfect. Okay. I will note that right here.
Yeah.
Excellent. Awesome. So let me see. Does that cover, like, the latency? We started with Project Butter. Have you been working on latency stuff since then?
Yeah. I mean, latency isn't always an ongoing effort. Like, it's one of those things that if you, you know, I have to try to convince people that, like, 1 or 2 millisecond wins are big wins these days, because they add up, right? If, you know, I do a couple milliseconds this release and a couple milliseconds next release, eventually it adds up to a frame somewhere.
That is a huge win. I mean, anybody who's ever worked in graphics, again, when your entire frame time is 11 milliseconds or 16 milliseconds, 1 millisecond is a huge chunk of that.
Yeah, the problem is they look at the total, like, they took the total budget and they say, like, oh, we're at, you know, 55 milliseconds latency. What is one, like, can people really notice 1 millisecond? It's like, no, but they notice 1 millisecond 10 times over.
Yes.
And convincing people of that is somewhat challenging, but they're starting to come around to understand.
Well, I mean, that's what happens when you optimize in general, right? Like, when you run out of low-hanging fruits, what's left is doing a lot of, like, smaller optimizations.
Yeah. So that's what we're doing. We have lots of small optimizations, but, like, all the big wins at this point are going to come from just better scheduling, right? It's back to the original Project Butter effort of, like, figuring out how you line up input and output. Well, we just need to line them up better and better and better. And that's going to give us the biggest wins of all. And that requires, at this point, tighter hardware integration to do, which we can do.
Or what I call high-hanging fruit. That's the phrase. Thanks. Now. Yeah. You heard it here first. So gamepads.
Yeah.
That's quite a jump from...
it is. I figured we were at the end of latency, let's talk about gamepads.
The king of segues there.
You know what? I'll fix it in post. It'll be this amazing sort of monologue.
We were just talking about displays. How about we talk about brightness? Instead of gamepads.
Okay, backtrack if you must. Fine.
Yeah, so I think you guys have had Ben on to talk about the auto brightness efforts that we did. So that's my team as well. Ben's not my team. Ben is the partnering team on that. They work with us. They work with DeepMind to get it all shipped. My team is responsible for the platform side of it. So we collect the data. We pass it over to Ben. We help them investigate what's going on. We're the display experts. So we kind of give them some advice around what we think oddities in the data might be. And we work with the Pixel team to try to convince them of, like, hey, we should have better brightness, whether that's, you know, more accuracy at the low end, how we calibrate our panels, that kind of thing. The big thing that we did for Q was we looked at context. So we know what application you're in when we're deciding the brightness.
Oh, nice.
And it turns out we have a lot of evidence this actually really matters.
Yeah.
Most people will turn it up for photos and videos. I've got a lot of anecdotal evidence that people do this as well. And so we thought, like, well, what if we did this automatically for you? And it turns out to be a really bad idea as far as we can tell.
Really?
People hate this loss of control where, like, they go into a video and it goes up on them and they try to raise it anyways. And then when they leave the video, it drops back down again. So they're like, why is my brightness changing all of the time? This makes no sense to me. This is really annoying. But if you don't do that, they'll do it themselves anyways. Yeah.
I assume we do bump the brightness when you watch HDR videos, though, right? Because we kind of have to.
Yeah, so HDR videos is a special case. We bump the brightness to beyond max. You bump into what we call high brightness mode. So on OLED panels, each of the brightness levels is carefully calibrated. So you have, like, 255 levels or 1024 levels or whatever it is. And then you have one level that is just way above everything else called high brightness mode. So our panels do, like, one nit at the bottom and about 450 nits at the top. And then at the very, very top that we don't actually use today, we have about 700 nits, depending on the panel. Some of them are closer to 600, or Pixel 3, which is 550, which is kind of the bare minimum for HDR content.
700 nits, that's I have an OLED HDR TV, and I believe that's basically the brightness that they use. And it's kind of what you need to do HDR.
This is the point in the podcast where I pretend that I have no idea what you're talking about when you say nits, and I would like you to explain that term.
I mean,
obviously, I totally know,
yeah,
right?
But you're the king of nits, again.
For the sake of argument. All right.
Nits is basically just the number of photons being emitted by your display. It's how bright is your display at any given point. So when we talk about nits, the higher, the brighter your display is. And this matters because if you're out in the sunlight, for example, which is, I'm going to use a different brightness term, like
lumens. Like, how do nits relate to lumens? I'm used to seeing lumens on, like, light bulb classification, right?
Yeah, I hate having to answer this question because I never remember the relationship between.
So do you want to go into luminous flux versus luminous power versus...
Sure.
I always have to go, like, relook at my notes to figure out what all the various relationships between the nits terms are.
If you prefer, the nit is candela per square meter.
Yeah, That's the only one I remember.
And the candela, I believe, if I remember, it's like the brightness of a candle at like 1 foot away from you, something like this.
This is like having horsepower for your car.
I was just thinking. Yeah.
There's a relationship between them. I never remember what it is. I always have to go look it up.
I wrote for filament. I implemented all of that, like lux, nits, lumens, all the things. And yes, I need diagrams every time to remember which one is which and how they relate to each other.
Okay. Yeah. So I will give you the one other definition. So the other thing I'm going to talk about is lux. And lux is how much light is actually landing on a given surface area. So the sun produces about 10,000 lux.
No, it's 100,000.
Well, I mean, the sun produces a lot more than that. But if you're outside in broad sunlight, it's like, 100,000 is possible.
The sky, 30,000. At least in California, I don't know about London. Maybe that's the London
it's thing.
It's about
12.
Anyway, it's a lot.
It's a lot. So, I think our upper threshold right now is 10,000. So I think I stopped counting at that point. But you need about 700 nits in order to be sunlight visible pretty much all of the time. So for sunlight readability modes, you kind of want to hit this high brightness mode. A lot of other panels do it. But we don't have any room between 450 and 700. So like if you walk from inside and it's 450 or it's 200, it jumps straight to 700.
It's interesting. You make a good point because I ran into that against working on filament where we try to have physical light units. Mm-hmm. And you know, some people using it were surprised because we have this setup where you're outdoors, so we have the super bright sun, the super bright sky, and then they put a light bulb with, 1,000 lumens or something. They're like, I don't see it light anything. Like, yes, because the sun is so much brighter. I mean, it's the equivalent of what you're saying. And I feel like people don't realize that our eyes are really good at adapting to brightness changes from like the moon at like 1 lux to the sun at 100,000.
Yeah, I mean, it is insane how good our eyes are.
Yeah, and if you turn on like your car's headlights in, during the day, like they won't light up anything.
Yeah.
But they're really bright.
Yeah. Small fact. It actually matters. There's like lots of evidence out there that turning your headlights on during the day actually helps us avoid
accidents. But because your car will be more visible, but they won't light up the road.
No, it won't light up the road. Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
That's what I meant.
All right. I think I took us on a tangent asking what nits were. But
that was interesting.
You were in the middle of something else that I can't remember.
Oh, so HDR. Yeah, so like I said, we have a special mode for HDR where basically we just bump to the max brightness because they want to be in more in control of what their brightness situation is. So they're authored at a much higher. They're typically authored around 1,000 nits, I believe.
It's I think according to the specs, 1,000 nits is pretty much the minimum that you should author at. And I know that most games today are authored around that because there's no really any consumer displays. I think the best LCD ones go to like maybe 1500, 1700 nits, but not much more than that.
Yeah, that is the one big advantage of LCD is you can kind of go as bright as you want. The downside is you can't go as dark as you want, so you have to pick a trade-off here.
I think Matthias worked on Surface Finger, once told me he saw a prototype TV that was doing 10,000 nits, but it was water-cooled. There were like huge water pipes around it. Because turns out producing a lot of light costs energy.
Yeah. On the other hand, the reason why we don't just go to 700 nits all the time on our displays is it has the risk of burn-in. So like the higher your brightness is, the more you risk burn-in and the more power, obviously. But burn-in is actually the bigger concern here. So that's why we don't just run at 700 nits all the time. There's a pretty strict budget in terms of how long you can be in that mode. And authored content actually, like if it were to show you an all-white screen the whole time, would be really bad for you. Or all-white in certain bands or something.
So actually, tell me about burn-in. I remember burn-in as being a really big issue with old CRT monitors, and I thought it was kind of gone. Like, I haven't seen it in the real world until a family member showed me their phone, and they have solitaire card stacks burned into their display, which is horrifying from many, many aspects. But I was surprised to see it there, and I was also surprised that I haven't seen it elsewhere since it was so apparent on their display.
Don't modern panels do like smart stuff like subpixel jitter or...
So we do even more obvious stuff than that. I submitted a bug once against the lock screen team because I noticed that the time was like always offset weirdly, and I thought it was basically a pixel round off problem or something, or popping to random. And they're like, no, burn in. Like, wow, okay, well, I guess it works there because my screen's not burned in. But do we do more subtle stuff than that?
The panels do more subtle stuff than that. I don't actually know how effective some of that stuff is. Like, it doesn't seem like the risk of it has gone down year over year if you talk about the hardware team. So
it didn't fix the solitaire problem.
Yeah, I'm sure if you asked, they would tell you, it increases the lifespan 2x or something.
Well, it probably helps like in some limited fashion, I assume. Yeah. If you're going to show the same screen literally for hours on end, unless you shift everything all the time, I don't see how that would.
Yeah, so the way that most burn-in happens on OLED displays is this thing called differential aging, and that's basically like you light up some pixels more than you light up others, and the more you light up pixels on OLED, the more they decay, the less light they can actually show, so they show dimmer and dimmer in certain areas, which eventually shows up as burn-in of like the shape of the object, because that's the thing that you're kind of outlining with it, and that's where you're going to notice it most. So you see this with like the home button. If you have it with solitaire cards, you play solitaire a lot. Oh my goodness.
Right. And the specific effect I remember was that it was not burned in the color of the cards, but it was kind of a pink hue to everything, which means maybe they were dimmer in some color aspects of those pixels.
Yeah, and I think it's the blue phosphor that actually decays fastest, okay. But I'd have to go double check.
That's what I remember as well.
Yeah. But yeah, so some of the phosphors decay faster than others. You can't produce them all equally. So that's kind of what you'll see is like a less color in one area, which will show up like a shape of some hue.
Yeah, this kind of discussion reminds me, it's kind of like SSD drives or SSDs who do like incredibly complex things internally because they also have issues with things, you know, getting stuck or decaying. And we don't realize like when we use those devices of the incredible amount of technology that goes into making things function.
Yeah, and so we think about this every time we do like a system UI feature, right? Like AOD does this, which is probably where you see the
always on display.
Sorry, yeah, always on display, which is a feature that a few of us worked on a few releases ago. But yeah, that moves subtly around so you don't burn in all of the pixels. When you consider doing something like KeyGuard or when you consider doing something like SysUI overall.
And AOD seems to go to a lower brightness mode, right?
So AOD goes to a lower brightness mode mostly because we want it to kind of blend into the background. We don't like you're not actively looking at it, so we don't want to kind of shine and catch the attention that we would have from a normal display.
But I thought
power
it was,
savings.
Yeah. I thought it actually went into a very different mode because there's an effect that I again filed a bug and they closed because they couldn't get around it where it went into such a different mode that it kind of flashes when it switches between these two modes. So when it first dims out, you're still in like full on display mode. And then 10 seconds later, it flips into like low power display. Like what's the difference between those?
Yeah, so we do have a different display mode for low power states. And it does a lot of things. Like on some panels, it will reduce your bit depth to one bit. You can either go black or you can go white. That's it, that's your choice.
Yeah.
On other panels, it'll drop to, you know, 20 or 30 hertz. So as opposed to going to 90, like the lower you can drop your refresh rate, the better your power savings is there as well. So we do that too. You can turn off certain components of display hardware if you know you're not going to show above a certain brightness. So if AOD is capped at, say, like 300 nits, then you can turn off some components because you know you're not going to actually need to power to 450, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's kind of lots of small optimizations to get the power down on AOD.
But they all add up.
Yes.
And I remember for AOD, we were even discussing making changes to the rendering pipeline. What if we change the rendering pipeline to render the entire screen since it's black and white? What if we rendered only one channel instead of, you know, the typical RGBA that we do? Turns out probably wasn't worth it considering like the amount of engineering and the complexity, but that's the kind of macro of optimizations that we have to think about.
We also talked about doing like rendering multiple frames because it turns out time's kind of predictable. You get about a minute per minute. So if you just schedule those up and say like flip this at the minute mark, then it doesn't have to be perfectly accurate. Like nobody's timing, you know, kitchen timers off of like watching their AOD flip. So if it's within a couple seconds of it, then that would have been okay. But yeah, again, turned out not to be worth it. We wake up the CPU more often than that anyways, so may as well just run it.
So you know what this reminds me of is gamepads?
Yeah, exactly. It's again, king of the segues here.
Well, actually, if we go back to display for the other questions.
Yeah.
All right, gamepads, yeah, fine.
I don't know how you put Ramon and I both on the same podcast and expected us to talk about gamepads and not display.
I mean, I like to use gamepads, but...
Yeah, I mean, I can talk a little bit about gamepads. Again, this is something my team is deeply involved in.
Because that's something that Android has supported for a long time, right?
Yes, yeah, we've had gamepad support for quite a while. It was one of my starter projects when I joined the team was to make more and more gamepads work. Because at the time we were doing Nexus Q and Android TV.
TV was coming online, right?
I remember our first gamepads, Jeff Brown was working on them on Honeycomb. I don't know if they existed before, but that was definitely not a huge focus.
Yeah, Jeff added a whole bunch of... Jeff was my previous manager, who's now over on the Fuchsia team. And he added a whole ton of input device support. So we support things like we've always supported trackballs, as much as trackball, but mice and keyboards and game controllers and all sorts of stuff since Honeycomb, where, you know, you never know what you're going to need. So we have all of that support. So we added gamepad support back in Honeycomb. We added support for like a majority of controllers back in Jelly Bean MR2, I want to say, is kind of where I went out and just bought all of the controllers I could find on the market and added support for them.
So my understanding of supporting gamepads is, you know, they mostly have kind of the same number of buttons and they tend to be called the same, like A, B, X, Y. But my understanding is that two gamepads with the same layout, with the same buttons in the same place, with the same names are not mapped the same way.
Yeah. I mean, so basically nothing is, like, there's standards for Xbox and there's standards for PlayStation, and they mostly work. But outside of that, every game controller looks completely differently, and there's no real standard for it. So the first thing we did was we wrote a standard and said, like, this is how a gamepad appears on Android, regardless of what's on the buttons. This is like the, we call it Baxi, it's the ABXY buttons. This is the order in which they show. It's like the bottom button is always this, right? And so that's the first thing we had to do, because otherwise it was a complete mess. And that way game developers can always just put like kind of code to the standard that they expect rather than having to figure out each individual game controller. If you look at Steam, the number of like options you have to, you know, remap your controller and set things up in the proper way, like it's kind of insane.
Yeah, it's like the 90s where like with all the different joysticks or the sound cards and every game had to support themselves, like all the different... Yeah,
we support joysticks, by the way. The little, like, we have the hat trigger for the button on top and everything. We support everything.
I want to play the Atari 2600.
Yes,
if you can find an adapter for it, it probably works.
Well, you can find like you can find USB adapters for all kinds of old controllers.
Yeah,
I use Super Nintendo controllers on my PC. Thanks to that.
What would I need to...
Oh, I explicitly like... mapped the Super Nintendo controllers as well. All of the nice. USB Super Nintendo controller stuff, that all works. I literally bought like every game controller and adapter I could find and hooked them all up.
I forget what the joystick adapter was. Was it a 4-pin? I'm thinking
the
RS-232.
Or...
Yeah, the game port.
Was it like 9-pin? Because it was the was same on the Sega Genesis or Mega Drive.
So maybe RS-232 then. Wasn't that 5x4? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'll work on that. Real soon now.
Yeah.
So conclusion, we're old.
But yeah, so I mean, like we've had gamepad support for quite a while. The big push recently has been to standardize across the ecosystem. So like, let's make sure before we dive in, like there's a bunch of gamepads out there with like really advanced functionality. Like the PS4 controller has a gyroscope and an accelerometer in it. It has a little light bar at the back. It has a speaker. Yeah, it's got all sorts of crazy stuff in it.
Speaker and haptic, right? Doesn't it do haptic stuff for vibrations?
Stuff, yeah.
Or is that through the speaker?
No. Pretty much every gamepad has two rumble motors, a strong and a weak.
Yeah.
We support one rumble motor currently, so we don't have full support. You can rumble the device, you just can't pick which one you're rumbling, so you just get both.
Okay.
We have we're looking at fixing that, but that's one of the areas that we haven't quite worked out yet.
Okay.
Like I said, our goal has really been to standardize all of the existing buttons and D-pads and everything and get them into a shape that developers can use and expect.
So is this standardizing across, this is how developers should address them, or are you also talking to all the hardware manufacturers saying, please do this?
So we have an effort going both ways. So we have an effort to say, like, here's what the average controller should look like. And we wrote a bunch of drivers effectively for saying, you know, all the common controllers would just look like this out of the box. And then now we're writing CTS tests to make sure that, like, you know, if you're on a Pixel versus a Sony device versus a Samsung device, it doesn't matter. They all look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And, like, that's been our big effort. We also have another effort that we were doing more back in the Android TV days where we published a HID spec. HID is the Human Interface Device Protocol. It's what you get when you talk to a device over Bluetooth, when you talk to a device over USB. It doesn't matter. It's all the same protocol. And we published a spec and said, like, if you want to write a game controller for Android, this is the way it should look to get support out of the box. We've seen a couple controllers released with this. We've seen a lot more controllers released with a slightly different standard.
So, yeah, it's interesting because I have a couple of 8-bit Do or 8-bit Do controllers. And when you turn it on, there's different buttons you can press, and you can turn it on, like, for PC, for Mac, or for Android. And so I assume it has a slightly different mapping to just adhere to the...
Yeah,
standard.
I would assume so as well. Like, I'm assuming PC, they probably give the Xbox mapping so that everything looks okay there, that kind of thing. I actually haven't looked at them on the Android one. I own one of those controllers. I should check it out.
I've used it a lot. It works really well.
Oh, great.
So what kind of support do these controllers get? Like, it's not typical for someone to buy a phone and get a game controller. So how many application or game developers actually target these controllers? right? Or is it typical enough in, you know, all the ports that they do that it's just a standard part of, you know, the AAA games or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not everyone. Like, if you're a mobile-focused game, you basically, like your Flappy Bird, for example, you probably just have touch input. There's not that many people are hooking up a game controller to say, like, let me play Flappy Bird.
Yeah.
Unless they want to do it on TV, in which case they maybe have game controller support for that.
It's very nice for emulators.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's lots of like more controller-specific applications. Emulators are a great example. We see people like Square Enix producing a bunch of their backlog on Android. So game controller support there is quite nice, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag. The advantage of Android being an ecosystem and Android on the phone being the same as Android on TV means that when people write a game for TV and add controller support there, it usually comes back to the mobile version. So you get gamepad support there as well.
Yeah.
So are you happy about gamepads now?
Yeah, I'm really happy. But what it reminded me of was audio-coupled haptics.
There wasn't even a segue there. We could have talked a little bit about haptics and moved into audio-coupled. It's just...
Sure, we could try that. What about haptics? You know, we did mention this before, so maybe we could segue into talking about haptics.
I like haptics, I like audio. Is there any combination of both that exists?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I think game developers are actually, like, way ahead of us on haptics in a lot of ways. They've been thinking about haptics and game controllers for a really long time.
Yeah, the best example to me is the Nintendo Switch. They call it the HD Rumble, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've tried, like, some of the demos. It's really impressive. Like, you tilt the controller and it feels like there's marbles or ice cubes inside. And it's really fine-grained.
Yeah, I mean, if you have full control over your haptics motor, you can do some really, really interesting things. And that's some of the things that we're playing with now. I think last time I was on, I talked a little bit about how we, you know, placement of the motor and how you drive it effectively and measuring back EMF and all of these things in order to, like, get a really nice, crisp haptic experience.
Actually, can we back up and say, what is a haptic motor? Like, what is the actual hardware that is producing these things?
Sure.
Or did you talk about that last time and I should listen
to that? You should just go listen to your own podcast.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll be honest, I don't remember if we talked about it. I can recap really quick. So, I mean, there's a bunch of different technologies for doing haptics. The thing in the Switch and the thing in the Pixel 4 is the same. It's called a linear resonant actuator, which is basically a magnet, a weighted magnet that sits in a device and you have a coil of wire underneath. And you apply current to the wire, it creates a magnetic field around it and pushes it in a given direction. So depending on how you push current through it, changes where it's pushing.
So really, you shake something really hard.
Yeah.
So we basically just flip the current or reverse the current really quickly, and that just causes the vibration.
Yeah, exactly. So and so you have you basically measure the resonant frequency of it. So how fast can you flip the current and have it switch directions? And you drive you switch the current at that frequency.
It's actually interesting. A way you can test that directly is in the settings of the keyboard, of Gboard. You can set the direction of the haptic feedback, and it's in milliseconds. And every time I change phone, I like to tweak that a little bit. And the minimum duration at which the vibrations start.
Who would ever change the setting of their haptic direction? Oh, you
because
would.
Because I like haptics on the keyboard. I just want them to be subtle. And very interesting because, like, on some phones, you know, at 30 milliseconds, you'll get the haptic feedback. On others, like, you can go down to 20 or higher. Like, it's very different depending on the device.
Yeah, the big challenge with haptics for us as a platform is that there's a lot of variation in the hardware, both in terms of, like, what the motor is capable of, as well as how you drive it and, like, what the driver is capable of. So if you look back on Pixel 1, we had a linear resonant actuator. It's actually the same actuator that's in the Pixel 2, but if you put them side by side and hit the home button, it's immediately noticeable. Like, the most stark moment I remember is I was talking to Dave Burke, our VP, and he had a bug on his Pixel 2, and he went back to his Pixel 1, and I just got a message from him saying basically, like, I can't go back. This is so good. It is a game changer, I think.
Wait, but if the hardware was the same, then what was the
change? Because it changes how you drive it changes. So on Pixel 1, we used the kind of a built-in controller for it that comes as part of Qualcomm's boards. And it basically only knows how to turn it on for a period of seconds, and then it can do this thing called active braking. If you listen to the podcast that you weren't here for, I'll talk a little more about that. But you have to pick how long that active braking is on. It doesn't actually know when it's fully stopped or where it is.
Yeah.
So you just, like, it basically runs, like, if you were to imagine, you know, it was going, like, it was flipping every so often. If it flipped at that same frequency, but it was kind of the signal was inverted, right? So you're pushing against it rather than pushing it faster. But you just pick, like, stop for 10 milliseconds. And if it stops in that time period, then that's really nice. If it doesn't stop, then you start pushing it in the opposite direction and it starts going again. So it feels like this long, it's what we call ringing, this long ringing experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what we did in Pixel 2 was we actually got a haptics driver, which is, when I say driver, I don't mean like kernel code that knows how to understand the hardware. I mean like thing that actually drives the motor.
Yeah.
That knows the position of the motor. Again, measuring back EMF, it can figure out what its frequency is and kind of where it is roughly, and starts and pushes back on it at the appropriate times. So it knows when it's braked. When you hit a frequency of zero, you stop. You don't keep pushing.
Yeah, that does sound useful.
Yeah, it's really useful. But like, but this is my point. Is like, you don't really know what the driver is capable of from the upper levels of software. So without it, a haptic experience minimum is like 30 to 50 milliseconds. And with it, it's closer to 10. And that's a pretty stark difference for having the exact same motor inside.
Yeah, and I imagine we could write high-level APIs that would give you this kind of information, but then there comes the problem of making sure that we can surface the information properly, that it's tested, that you know it works reliably across devices.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about how do we create a kind of a standard for what a high-quality haptics experience looks like. And it's things like being able to stop within 10 milliseconds, providing you know, 1.5 Gs of force out of it or whatever the metric is. It's challenging though. Like there's a lot of things that go into it that, you know, sometimes you like the right combination will create a good experience, but if you know you had a 1.5 G motor and it takes 50 milliseconds to stop, that's not good. Yeah, not easy.
So I remember when you and Schumann's team were working on this, I had assumed that there was a lot of sort of software platform changes, but it you're saying it was like closely linked to what the hardware was capable of at the time.
I mean there was definitely both. Right, like the time when we started doing this, we looked at it, we only had on-off timings. You could say turn on for 50 milliseconds, turn off for 50 milliseconds.
Yeah.
That was the sum total of our control. And it turns out that's not nearly enough to give you a good experience.
Right. And the result that I remember, like the demos at the time were like, wow, that is a stark change. We're basically like clicking on keys on the keyboard and like getting the feedback that you expected. It just felt mushy. I think in comparison,
that's the ringing. So that if you can actively break, if you can like really stop the effect quickly, that's what creates what we call a clean, crisp effect.
Yeah.
Which is where we focused the last couple of releases is like, how do we produce really nice clicks? What does it mean to be a nice click? It turns out to be like a fairly deep area of study.
And have you seen it in the ecosystem since then? Like this was our first approach, the Pixel 2. And I assume the later Pixels as well, but I would hope that it's sort of permeating through the rest of the hardware ecosystem as well.
Yeah, I mean, it gets called out in a lot of reviews. We're really happy about that. And so I think other parts of the ecosystem are responding and are improving their haptics experience as well to do this. I want to go back to Ramon's comment about how he changes the haptic setting slider in keyboard. Please don't ever do that.
So it works for me.
Well, so if you reset it, I'm curious if you reset it, if you still like the feeling, because what happens if you don't change it, you get our highly tuned, really well designed click effect. If you change it and you say, I want a 10 millisecond click, it just turns the motor on for 10 milliseconds and then stops it, which has active braking, but it's probably not as nice.
I see. All right, I'll try to reset it Pixel 4 to make you happy.
Yeah. Just give it a shot. Like, try it out for a day or two.
Actually, why is the setting there?
It probably mattered on other devices because of the kind of effect you're talking about, the ringing. Because, you know, like having the haptic feedback on the software keyboard, I think, at least to me, it really helps. But if you're on a device where, you know, it vibrates for too long, it does feel bad. Like it doesn't feel like you're typing on a keyboard.
Yeah. So I mean, the long and short of it is the Gboard, the Google keyboard, is available on more than just Pixel. It's available across the ecosystem, and the rest of the ecosystem isn't quite in the same spot that Pixel is.
Okay.
So my advice is strictly for Pixel users, try to reset it or try not to change it. I mean, you can if you like the other experience better, do it, and you know that's fine, and we watch that as a metric as well. But
you're too kind.
Yeah.
It does seem like something like we, you know, Pixel team can do what they want, just like any OEM. I assume that they could also just adjust the settings to have things that are appropriate for their devices. And I just wonder, like, if we've so finely tuned this, does it make sense to have the general setting?
Well, the setting is in the keyboard app itself. So the keyboard app is the one that tells us to vibrate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. I was set on the system default. So I did try. And on Pixel 4, I prefer the default. So you are right.
Yeah, that's good. But I mean, like I said, like that's where we spent the majority of our time optimizing for particular effects is that.
Yeah, and haptics, when they work well, like it's pretty amazing how they can fool us. Again, it reminds me of the MacBook Pro when they switched to this glass trackpad. The fact that when you click on it, you're not clicking something, there's just haptics. And honestly, like at first I was afraid, I'm like, this is going to be horrible. And yeah, I
Yeah, I mean, Apple's haptics program is amazing, both on their phones, on their laptops, kind of everywhere. They really understand what they're doing. It is very impressive.
So yeah, good question about haptics.
Yeah.
Audio haptics, what's that?
So let's talk about audio coupled, which is kind of our one of our other big features for Q. So for, what is the release before Q? P?
That's how the alphabet works, yeah.
Android 9.
Android.
Because I know that 9 comes before 10.
So for P, we did this thing where we sort of audio coupled, where we had a pre-built ringtone or a pre-built haptic effect that was associated with a ringtone, and you would just tell them to play simultaneously, and you hope that there were no delays, or if there were delays, they were about equal, which we tried to make sure was true. But then if there were any further delays, it kind of skewed, right? Like you were trying to play this haptic effect that in time with the audio ringtone or the audio alarm or whatever it is. So that when you get some energy in the audio side of it, you also feel a haptic bump on the haptic side, which is slightly nicer than just like what we have today, which is just long, like 1 millisecond buzzes, basically. This worked okay, but wasn't really a sustainable effort. We constantly, like everything was very device specific. We constantly had to add new constants. If you wanted to add more ringtones, well, you needed a new ringtone constant. And because they changed device to device, like on Pixel 3, we kind of have a different set of audio than on Pixel 2. It just wasn't a great system to work within. So what we did for Pixel 4 was we actually went a step further, and now they're truly audio coupled. There is a channel on the audio container that is actually a haptic signal, because a haptic signal looks very much like a really low frequency audio signal. You know, you can play say you have a resonant frequency of 100 hertz. For the motor, you can play like a 100 hertz sine wave versus a 100 hertz square wave versus a 100 hertz, you know, whatever else you want to play. And you actually can feel differences between these different types of waves.
Yeah.
So is that available as part of the APIs? If I use the media APIs, can I create my own track with the haptic signal?
You can. We haven't published exactly how you do this.
Okay.
part of the problem is there is still a degree of... device specificness to this API, which is why we haven't fully published it. We're trying to figure out like what the right way to represent this is, so that per device we can, you know, modulate it in the right way so that it looks the same, basically.
So where do we use that out of the box? Let's say on my Pixel 4, is it when the phone rings? Is it in other situations?
Ringtones and alarms are where we use it. So when you get a ringtone, when you get a ringtone, basically, you will hear this play in time, but only for ones that have it enabled. So all the out-of-the-box ones have it enabled. If you add your own ringtones, we don't do any sort of like on-the-fly translation or anything like that.
Is this also what becomes the vibrate? I usually have my phone on vibrate mode, right? So is the haptic the sound for vibrate?
No, because it doesn't make sense once you remove the audio side of it. It is really like intimately tied to the audio side of things. So if you play a ringtone, like I said, we basically look for energy on the audio side and translate that into energy on the haptic side. So it's not just not just looking at the bass notes, not just looking at the very low frequency audio signal or anything like that.
Oh, you're actually like increasing the strength of the haptic signal based on the strength of the audio.
I mean, that's right. Like these are all designed, and then these are like actually processed; they're not automated.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of the idea behind it.
I will listen to my alarms more closely. I hadn't noticed this.
No, you have to feel your alarms more closely.
Yeah. So set an alarm, hold it in your hand, see what you think. But you're doing this trade-off of like, you want to create a nicer experience. You get lots of complaints that like people's phones on their desks still feels a bit angry. This is not really an emotion you want associated with your phone.
Oh, to be clear, the phones are angry.
Yeah. Why haven't you answered me already? I'm top priority. But so you have to balance this, like creating a really nice haptic experience, whether it's in your pocket, on a desk, wherever, with also like you need to get their attention. If you don't get your attention for the phone call, you've failed, right? Like that's your job.
Yep.
So we're balancing these two things of making sure there's enough energy there that we get attention still, while not being an angry signal.
Okay. Happy, nice phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Helpful.
So Pixel 4, the less angry phone.
I'll send that to marketing. See what
that
they
should
say.
Be the TV ads.
All right. I'm wondering deep whether touch. We called all the. Deep touch.
Of haptics, just go back to input during our display segment.
Yes.
What is deep touch?
Yeah. So I mean, deep touch is basically a long press accelerator. Do we think this is a useful signal, and what can we do? So we, rather than looking at adding extra hardware into Pixel, which is has lots of hardware in it already, we said, well, let's look at this actual, let's play to Google's strengths. Let's look at the data that we have. So we started piping up some of the heat map information from the touch controller itself, which historically we haven't had access to. It's just been the touch vendor saying like, hey, here's where the touches are. Here's where like the size, of, the rough size of them, that kind of thing.
So yeah, and that was when you mentioned that earlier before we started the podcast. Like that is new to me. I didn't realize we have a heat map of the touch sensor. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I want to see it.
And we worked with the upstream kernel actually to get it up in a standardized way, so it shows up as a V4L2 buffer. If you're familiar with the video layer on Linux.
Sorry, can we go back and explain? You know, again, I will pretend to not know what you're talking about. Heat map. So what does this come out as?
Yeah, I mean it's a good question. So the touch sensor itself is basically like a grid of sensors, and you measure at each point, and then you measure for each row and each column.
Okay,
and you can see it sometimes at an angle on some displays.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah,
pretty cool.
Right.
You'll see the actual traces, but yeah, you're basically and every time you measure it, it's not just a single like presence no presence signal. There's a strength indicator to it. Because you're basically measuring parasitic capacitance. You're measuring like how much like the change in capacitance levels for each one of these nodes.
And I assume because we've always had that API on Android where there was the size of the touch, and I assume it's inferred from that, right?
Yeah. So size of touch is, you look at basically the signal strength of the surrounding nodes, and there's not actually that many of them. It's like typically like. What is it, like 22 by 12 or something like that? There's not that many intersections. There's a lot of intersections. Not many, that many traces, though.
Wait, I'm trying to figure out, when you're talking about the signal strength of everything surrounding it, like, we don't measure how hard you're pushing on any of these things. Is more the surface area that is covered by an input event?
It's a mixture of the two, which is why we can actually extract the deep touch information out of it. Because what you're measuring is kind of how close your finger is to the sensor itself. And when you push on it, you actually deform the screen just a little bit.
Yeah.
And you're doing two things. You're adding more fleshy area at the bottom of your finger, so you're increasing the width. And you're deforming the screen a bit on some displays. And so we look at that change and say, like, do we think any of these things are happening to determine if you're actually pushing? We call it a force press.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we actually can derive whether you're pushing into this. I didn't realize that we had information on the screen deformation.
Well, I mean, the screen deformation comes from the fact that you're changing the distance between the two electrodes.
Right.
Like it's also inferred.
And getting closer to it. Yeah, so it's not really that we have screen deformation information. And I mean, to be honest, it's machine learning, so it could be looking at a completely different signal for all we know.
Yeah.
Like this is kind of our understanding of it.
We submitted it to our ML algorithm and it came back and said, that's a cat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. We have a really good cat detector for touch screens these days.
So, but back to my question about heat map, I still don't know what is the information that you're getting from this? So,
sure. So the heat map itself is basically like a 2D grid of all of these measurements.
Okay.
And so we call it a heat map because you can kind of see like the area where the center of our touch is will have our Z value is a lot higher, basically like how much we're changing the capacitance levels there.
Yeah.
And as you go further and further from that, it gets less and less basically.
Yeah.
So it looks like a heat map of like touches.
Okay.
We on Pixel 4, I think we only have local heat map information, so we don't pass up the full thing. We pass up a small grid around the fingers to figure out where the touches or like to figure out what that touch is doing. And there's some other things that go into this. Like this is post noise processing, so we're not doing noise processing on the AP. We're just looking at like the information around the finger after we've removed anything that we believe to be noise.
Okay. And what do we do with this information then?
Yeah. So back to our
fast long press or short long press.
Yeah. Quicker long press. Today it's quicker long press. Like I'm more excited about the eventual capabilities of this. We have this information now. Google is really good at using, you know, like lots of information and figuring out what to do with it. I think there's a lot of abilities we have there. But for now, what we're doing is this accelerated long press. We're calling it deep touch.
Okay.
So the idea being like we can judge whether a long press is happening far before the timeout based on kind of what the physical mechanics are. If you see the width of the fleshy part of the finger touching the screen expand, if you see, you know, maybe it's deformation, maybe it's something else. As you see these things, you can kind of judge whether the finger is going to be there for a long period of time or not.
Yep.
Or whether it's pushing hard or not. And using these, we accelerate the long press gesture.
Now we can
gesture.
Just trigger it. And
so
is it...
We have angry phones, but we also have angry users. And if we see that they force press everything, they're probably very angry.
We just take bug reports.
Angry users probably get to use their UIs much faster then. So finally, being angry is paying off for me.
Yeah.
So then is it a graded scale? Like, do we do it faster depending on how hard they're pushing, or is it just a heuristic saying this is a fast versus not?
It's a binary signal coming out of it. It's okay. Just like, once we've determined that we believe this to be a deep press or a force press or whatever you want to call it, we just send that signal up to userland as a hint on the motion event and say like, hey, we think that this is X. In this case, we think it's a deep touch, and our default deep touch recognizers will all react accordingly, whether you're using the view one, whether you're using the gesture detector one, doesn't matter, it all happens.
So one of the interesting elements to this, is we've been talking about, you know, related UI stuff for a while, you know, input side, and then what do we do with it? And there's an awkward aspect where UIs and input types were determined long ago in Android and elsewhere, and then how do you overlay a new signal on top of that, right? We have a motion system, we have an input system, you know, you can detect a click, a tap, a move, a long press, and then all of a sudden you have this new thing. Well, apps are probably interpreting all of these things in ways that they already know of, right? So what do we do with this new signal without kind of making other stuff awkward?
Yeah, so that's why we chose to accelerate long press. We didn't want to add a new signal in this. This is something that we were very explicit about from the beginning, was we didn't want this to be a new gesture. Yeah. The gesture space is already kind of constrained. Like, it's already overfilled. And so when we think about press, you look at it on a time axis and you look at it on a force axis, and there's a lot of it overlap between the two to try to distinguish the two of them. So like, we don't actually think users are capable of meaningfully expressing force versus long press consistently. It's challenging at the very least, right? Outside of a demo scenario.
And did you do user studies to see whether this was sort of getting people into this bucket of long presses where they didn't intend to?
Sorry, the deep touch stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, so we didn't do user studies. We did the data studies for that to make sure that we're not overtraining towards always hitting long press. But we didn't explicitly do anything to try to differentiate the two, because we didn't. We wanted it to be the same signal.
Yeah, because I can imagine there might also be accessibility challenges, right? Like, for instance, if the deep touch meant something special in our UI, if it's difficult to do for some users, that could be an issue.
Yeah, it was definitely a concern that we had in terms of data gathering. We were aware of it at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the danger here, it seems like a nice overlap of the new gesture on top of existing functionality that makes sense. The main danger, I would think, is, well, what if somebody's just used to tapping things really hard? Probably the same people that type in, you know, all caps. And therefore, they're always going to end up in this, like, gesture that they didn't used to.
That's why we're I keep using the word force because it's the most analogous system to this. I should probably avoid it because it's not strictly force that we're looking at. There is also a time aspect to it as well.
Yeah.
So if you slap your phone really hard, but you have quick taps, theoretically, this should not trigger. This is really about accelerating what we believe to be a long press gesture. So if you just kind of push hard rather than you know, just holding it, you'll get a faster signal trigger out of it.
Yeah.
So we hopefully avoid that kind of angry typer gets long press behavior situation.
Or what we could do is detect every time you do one of those deep touches, we can just use the haptics to tell you to stop doing that.
And
you're
also
angry, I'm angry too.
We could even, you know, switch the email program to just start emitting all caps as well. Aren't we supposed to be doing like more machine learning and trying to make the phone, you know, fit the personalities of the people?
I don't know why you're wasting this on a podcast instead of like filing an IDF or something on it. This is a missed opportunity there, chat.
All right. Well, speaking of missed opportunities, did you want to say something quick about API Council?
That sounds like a leading question.
Yeah. We've never talked about this on, but you brought this up before the podcast, where you are one of many people on the framework team, especially that thinks about, okay, do these APIs across all of the stuff that's shipping as public APIs make sense for developers?
Yeah, I mean, I
that would be great if your answer was no.
No, I have no idea.
What are you talking about?
I mean, I did want to, I mentioned it mostly because I think it's an interesting aspect of what we do, and it's something that's grown over time. Like, I remember when we started out, it was kind of getting into a room with Diane and a few of the other like framework leads, and just looking at the long list of APIs that were coming out that release and making sure there were no glaring, horrible things going.
Yep.
And then that turned into these kind of, you know, weekly meetings where we'd all get in a room and we'd look at the diff between when we started and what we had. And we'd go through all of the APIs one by one in that diff, and we made it to the bottom. We would have them create a new diff and do it again. And so you end up looking at the same APIs, like, I don't know, 10 times before it release.
It felt very much like editing a book.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you do it over and over and over again.
Well, and the worst part was if you got like a different set of people in the room, or like one person was like, you forgot you looked at an API, you might give conflicting advice. It didn't work very well.
Well, no, yeah, but also what was difficult is, you know, Android is an OS and there are APIs for many, many, many things. And sometimes you do need to be a little bit of an expert in the area to understand whether the APIs are the right ones. Especially because there might be some standards in terms of namings or conventions or things that people might be used to in that particular domain that don't necessarily make sense in the rest of the APIs, but it's okay there.
Yeah, this is particularly true for the media stack. So having a media, at the time, I don't think we had a media expert in the room almost ever. So it was kind of challenging. We were all kind of creating our own bit of media expertise just so we could understand what in the world is going on.
Yeah, the one I have in mind is, for instance, how do you name APIs for color spaces where they have the concept of, you know, they use X and Y, but the lowercase x and y don't mean the same thing as the uppercase x and y. There is even the xyy. Yeah, we do the different lower and uppercase. And so if you just go by the strict naming conventions, you lose some meaning there, which may or may not matter. But that's what I think makes, you know, the API console a difficult task, because sure, you can just look at the names of the getters and say, that's not a great name, but we need more than that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the API Council always gave feedback. It's not like we went and changed the APIs ourselves. So there's always an opportunity to say, like, I disagree. And hopefully people will recognize that opportunity. But it's grown since then. We're not just like one group of people sitting in a room once a week and looking at the same APIs 10 times over. We've actually split out into pods and that kind of thing. So now we have experts from all of the areas, whether that's media, camera, UI toolkit, framework, looking at the APIs.
Yeah, and really to the API console, but for those who are not familiar with the AOSP, the way we build the platform is if you add a public API that breaks the build, you need to run a special build command to update. We have this a text file that contains all the APIs for the current API level, and you need to consciously say, yes, I'm adding a public API. It shows in code reviews, and that's the kind of things we can look at. So there's a whole process involved beyond just people like looking at the APIs at the end.
Yeah, and the key detail that I kind of wanted to communicate was that, like, we do look at all of our APIs going out. We do care quite a lot about these APIs and how the API surface looks. I think it's gotten a lot better in the last couple of years in terms of creating the API console that lets us give a little bit more consistency to the APIs and what we do. It's an interesting process. It's definitely not something I've ever had to do anywhere else before.
There's not that many companies that I think have to solve this problem, which is like large developer platform, backward compatible, you know, need to provide documentation. Documentation is one of those things that comes out of API Council as well. Like, I think back in the day, you know, pre-Honeycomb, like stuff was going in really quickly and didn't necessarily get documented. And I don't think people were watching that, right? But it's kind of nice to have the sanity check going, oh, you know what? Actually, this method is not inherently obvious. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a comment on that? And so I think they were much more consistent about that cross-platform than we used to be.
Yeah, that, and we also try to enforce CTS tests, so there's ecosystem compatibility guarantees. We talk to a lot of developers about adding support library versions, so if there's you know, skew between various platform releases, like, can we make sure that this is paper over so developers don't have to use it?
And we do have a milestone for every release where after that a certain date, you can't put new APIs in. Can keep working on the implementation, but the APIs have to be stabilized.
Yeah.
If only to give the API consoles time to look at them.
Yeah, because we do look at every single API that's released and sign off on it, which is, as the team grows, a lot of APIs, it turns out.
Yes, it is. All right. Did we forget to cover anything that you really, really wanted to talk about today?
No, I think we hit all the high points.
Awesome. Then thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.